Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back again. My name is Adam Aditya Smita from AGI. With me we have Sony.
I'm Sony. I'm from the Lazy Monday.
All right, how are you, Sony?
I'm doing great, actually. It's been fine.
Awesome. And today we're going to talk about something very, very interesting with a very, I think, it's very amazing guest from Germany, from Köln. We have a very special guest that going to share with us his journey into the game industry. And I think it's going to be also very interesting, right, Sony? Because we can learn about what happened if we run a game developer company in Germany.
Yeah. All right. A lot of questions that we're going to ask.
Yes, a lot of questions that we're going to ask. So without further ado, we're going to introduce to you all Tim Schroeder from Massive Mini. Hello.
Hey, nice to meet you. Hello.
Thank you so much for coming into our podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
To begin with, maybe can you do a little bit introduction about your role and your daily activities?
Yeah, I can try to make it quick. So yeah, hi, I'm Tim. I'm managing director of Massive Mini team and one of the three co-founders. We founded the company now 6 years ago. And I'm working in the industry for now a bit more than 10 years. I was a programmer before. I also have like some experience with numbers and Excel sheets and finances, because my education back then was like 50% programming, 50% business. And so I was the only one with some business knowledge. So I also took care of the finances because I could do it and the others couldn't. And now I'm the managing director, doing not much programming anymore. The team asked me kind of nicely to not program in projects anymore. So I don't do now tooling and finances, managing stuff and org stuff and all this stuff, but still a little bit of programming.
All right.
Do you miss it, Tim?
Sorry, again?
Do you miss programming?
Yes, but this is why I do the tooling. It's the tooling is nice because it's much smaller scope. Like a game takes 2 to 3 years, so this is the reason why I am not participating much anymore. I mean, I do some smaller stuff sometimes, some technical stuff, some engine stuff, but it takes more time to understand the code base, and our tools are quite small, so I can do this without causing too much troubles for other people. But yeah, I'm missing it because programming, I'm doing it for now, 15 years or something longer. I really like it. But yeah, I can still do it sometimes, so it's a good mix.
Okay. All right. That is interesting. We're gonna talk a little bit about that later on, about your experience too. So every guest in the podcast, we're gonna start about sharing about the journey. So Tim, do you still remember when and why, what's the trigger for you to jump into the game industry? Is it something that you already have in mind as a dream since you're a child, or like something happens along the way in your career and you switch into the game industry? Can you share your journey a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I started playing video games when I was, I don't know, 4 or 5. My father was also playing video games. My brothers were playing video games. So it was like basically in my life from the get-go. So my first memories I can think of are just connected to games. So it was always like, okay, games are being made by people. But I always thought like, no, you have to be a mastermind. And I knew about polygons, and I thought like, okay, you have to arrange every polygon by hand somehow to make 3D stuff happen, and just too much for me, so I'm not smart enough. So after school, I went into programming for a corporation to work on big enterprise systems, where we did a lot of data transformation by code. And when I did some code, we were talking optimizations about minutes, because stuff was running at night. So it could take like one tool, like 2 hours. And it was like, okay, now optimize the tool by, it takes 3 minutes less. So we're talking about optimization in minutes. Now it's about milliseconds if you go to games, for example.
Yeah.
But the big enterprise systems were quite slow to change. And we had like, our core of the system was like 20, 25 years old. So it was very weird. So I wanted to have something more agile. And I moved then into, this was a time like 2008, 2009, 2010, around when the iPhone came around and everyone went to mobile apps. So I learned how to make mobile apps and went over to programming for iPhones. I also went to work freelance, worked with some startups and some other clients, and they were always asking, hey, you can make apps, but can you also make games? And I always said no, but then I tried to look a little bit with Cocos 2D and how the 2D frameworks work. And at the time, it's somehow Unity said like, hey, before you had to pay like $400 or $500 for the Android and iOS modules, it's now free to publish with the splash screen thingy. I was like, yeah, maybe I check out Unity. And then I started using Unity. It was a lot of fun, got the first contracts, then was also a Unity developer somehow. And then got at some point a company, I was like, hey, do you want to join full time? We are looking to build an internal department to make games. This was a publishing house for books. They wanted to tap into the market of apps and move their books also into the app stores. They built a new department and I joined them making like smaller games for children. And from there I went to industry events, talked to other people, got connections and went on to other companies, made a lot of VR games in the beginning. And after having some experience in other studios, I met my co-founders and we were like, hey, we're really good together as a team and maybe we should do something together to build the studio we want to work at. And then we did this basically. So yeah, in the end it was just like making connections and being at the right time, talking to the right people. It's totally random, so it's very hard to replicate the same goal. But yeah, I hope this answers the question how I ended up here.
Yeah, Sonny, you want to ask something?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have quite a similar path then, especially here in Indonesia, right? No, starting from mobile apps and then they start creating their own studios.
True.
Yeah, it's the same for Germany. I mean, we have a lot of stuff for automotive, so making cars or like big corporates, but gaming is not the biggest industry we have here and there are not many well-known studios from Germany. So you have a lot of small studios, a very smaller landscape of indie studios, a few big ones, mostly from the time for mobile games, and then a few other ones right now, of course, like Crytek and other companies. But it's, I don't know, different than compared to France, UK, like our European neighbors, or also America. Yeah. It's a much different landscape because you have a lot of, like, you have a lot of universities here also, and so they split out the students and they start new companies and make the experiences, but you don't have many companies who are around for like 10, 15, 20 years. It was a bit hard at the time to just find a place where you want to work because you didn't have so many opportunities. I also looked back then at some universities. So right now, since a few years, you don't have to pay for most universities in Germany. It's kind of free and paid by by tax money. Back then, you still had to pay some stuff, and there was some private universities, and it was like, hey, if you want to go to games, you have to pay €25,000 or more, and this was not affordable for me. So it was like kind of unachievable to go to work at companies because I was like, no, there are not many spots left and you have to have experience and you have to go to those expensive universities. So yeah, this is just this way about talking to people and finding small companies doing our own stuff is the way to go for many people here too.
One of also the challenge to fund a studio is like finding the right partners. When you like try to co-found this company, what makes you like think that, hey, I think we have the same vision and we need to work together? Do you need to work with them first before you decided that you want to make a studios, or like they are your old buddies before and you already trust them, or like you have the same dream, the game that you want to make, something like that?
So when we found the studio, basically we had been working at a studio before where we saw many people coming in, being laid off, coming in, laid off. So it was like always this up and down with people. And we were kind of the core team. And it was kind of sad to see so many people joining the company and leaving the company. So then we decided, okay, let's do our own stuff. But we know making games is hard. It's a hit-driven business, so you have to have a hit to fund people. And also, you can have like 10 very successful games. If the 11th game is not turning out well, you might have to lay off your people. So we are trying, okay, how can we change that? And we were looking for not making games in the beginning. It was always our dream. But we felt like, okay, we need like money coming in somewhere, and this is not games, because games take like 2-3 years, and we don't want to wait for a hit game. So we started doing everything, like gamification, or consulting companies about how to move to gamification, or just doing educational stuff in VR or visualization for other companies, for bigger companies. So we did a lot of stuff like this, which is not games, but it's at least within Unity or Unreal or other 3D stuff. So it was kind of close, and we can transfer our knowledge from making games to the stuff. So we use this one to get in some funding, and from the funds we try to make our own games, and then try to find partners who we would like to work with. So we right now, since 2 years, part of THQ Nordic, which is kind of nice. So we're part of this big Embracer group, and Handy Games. So we're now part of them, and we met them at some events. So because we were quite aligned on what we want to do, this was very important. But yeah, in the beginning it was just staying alive and creating a sustainable work environment for us. Because when we went to other studios, we always saw like a lot of young people there and not many old people. And games have been made for like, I don't know, 30, 40 years, right? So there has to be some old people who made the games back in our times when I was like 5, right? But where are they? So they're not working on games anymore. So we were like, how is this? And then like, yeah, of course, if you, it's not a sustainable environment, if you want to grow old, if you want to have a family, if you want to have, I don't know, a house or living at least in a flat or whatever, you have to have some stable income. And games cannot provide this all the time. So we started like, okay, let's try to make it sustainable. And this was for us like, okay, we don't start with making games. We start with using our knowledge to get a stable income of revenue. And yeah, it worked out quite good. But it, of course, it was a lot of working for clients is always hard, especially people who are not known to games. I mean, even for game companies, it's hard. But if you have like people who don't know stuff about anything and just ask questions and sometimes come in with the confidence of, we are a big company, we know our shit, but then they don't know it, it's like, it was so much, it was an interesting experience. Right now, we're not doing this anymore for the last 2 years, because now, since being part of Embrace and THQ Nordic, we don't have to do this. But you learn a lot in a short amount of time about how to get stuff done. So we made like two and a half years, like 50 or 60 projects with clients. So you learn how to get stuff done.
Well, how, really is it hard though, Tim? I mean, managing the, I mean, you have like two divisions, right? But one is your main source of income, and then the other is for your project, which is, you know, your passion project, which is the gaming side. How hard is it to manage those two sides? Because you have to recruit, or is it the same team that works on that, or how does that work?
So in the beginning, we were like 7 people, and everyone was doing everything. So we had people working on like a contract job for clients, and when they were done or had to wait or whatever, they could move over to make our games. The problem with this one is, I mean, of course, we prioritized somehow the contracts or the projects which kept us running. So this is mostly like the work for clients. So somehow the game was like our first game, which we made in the time, was Bitlings. And the priority was contract work. And sometimes there's a feeling like, okay, this is our side project, our game, and you cannot spend the time you want to spend on it. And sometimes the games is just, and maybe we have the feeling the game is lacking some quality because of that, because we had to prioritize client work over our game so much time. And it was very hard, because you would like to improve your game. You would like to, I don't know, make more levels, make better mechanics, or make a new feature, but you couldn't because there's a deadline for this client next week and we have to move 4 people over to this one. It was always a pain point to balance this, and I'm not sure if we have done a very good job. It worked out somehow in the end, but it's complicated. We then started to think of, okay, can we make a proper split in the company, like splitting it into 2 teams and basically hire for the client stuff. So we have like 1 team of a few people who make games, a team of a few people who make stuff for clients. But it's hard to do this stuff, because when you say we want to use our knowledge about making games and transfer it to working for clients, we need people who know how to make games. And if you have like one team who makes games and the other one has to make the client stuff, of course the people will be jealous of the other team because they have to now work on this application for, I don't know, this fire safety training what we did, where other can like, hey, we can make our own game. And we didn't do this because when we wanted to do this at the time, we then got the offer from Embracer to join Embracer. But we were planning to do it, but I don't know if it would have worked out. Because just keeping motivation up for the team is quite hard, I guess.
But that is really interesting. I mean, like, having a company like Embracer to join, like, collaborate with you, that's huge, right? I mean, what's the process? Well, I mean, like, have you talked with them in the future, work with them in the future, and they saw your work, and then, hey, I think we can work together in the future? Or, like, how's that happen?
Yeah, so the entire chain of Embracer is it's a bit more complicated. So Embracer is like the top company, then coming THQ Nordic, and then it's coming Handy Games, and then us. So Handy Games is like our mother, basically. THQ is our grandmother, and then so on. I don't know. It's a very, very weird family tree. How it happened? 2019, I guess, we went to a small conference in Switzerland. And we showed our game Spitlings. We tried to find a publisher for the game. So in the beginning, we had a different project going on, internal project. This didn't turn out that well. We weren't happy with the progress. So we made a small internal game jam, and Spitlings was the result of this game jam. And then we showed it at DevCom and Gamescom, and people liked it. So it was like, because this project was meant to just be like an exercise for us to make games, maybe put it on itch.io and then just leave it there for free or maybe for like 1 year or whatever. But then people liked it. So we were like, maybe we should continue working on this one and maybe try to find a publisher. So we talked to publishers and went to events and I don't know, we talked to 50, 60, 70, 80, I don't know how many publishers, basically everyone who can publish games, we talked to them and tried to meet them on all the events and all the stuff. And then we went to Switzerland to the event, to Ludicious, and we had the meeting with Handy Games. We had the game, so we were exhibiting the game so they could play it, but when they came, they had to wait for like, I don't know, an hour or something to play the game, even though they had an appointment scheduled with us, but there was not like behind the scenes stage where you can just show games, so it was, they had to stand in line basically. But because we were always we were very strong to make games on multiple platforms. So we already did ported the games to Switch, Xbox, and PlayStation because we had the data dev kits in the office. Because multi-platform is kind of in our DNA. So we already had we had like a Switch dev kit with us, and we could just give them the dev kit like, here, you can play the game on Switch. And because Handy Games likes also to put out games on all platforms, and they're like, okay, we like the game, we like the art, we like everything, we like that it's running multiple platforms, we like you, so let's talk. And we talked, and then we worked with them, so they signed Spitling to publish it. Then we worked with them. We also started helping them out with porting some of their games to other platforms. We were also doing some porting business. This was kind of necessary because back then we did a lot of stuff for events, and turns out events are not that great when a global pandemic is be around. Overnight we lost our entire revenue stream from events, so we had to move to other stuff, so we moved to porting. So this then turned out, so we ported some stuff for Indie Games and other clients. But because we did Spitlings, we ported some more complicated projects and we worked with them on a lot of stuff, they said, these guys are really good. And we like where they're going, and our vision kind of aligns. So we started talking about joining Embracer, and we joined Embracer over Handy Games. So they acquired us, and we're now in this big family tree. But yeah, we worked with them before, and it was nice from us, it was nice from them. So even the entire talk about the acquisition was pretty chill. And it just felt right.
So the pandemic is actually a blessing then.
Kind of. I don't want to go back because we had some remote work before, so we weren't hit. I mean, it wasn't a very big change to all the stuff how we have to work because we had everything on like Google Docs or on Teams or whatever already before the stuff, so it was like kind of fine. So we didn't have to change many workflows. We could still just continue working. Wow. There was just like missing interactions. People was very hard for us. Just having, when it hit in Germany, like in March 2020, it was like expected, like, okay, yeah, we do like now 4 weeks of staying at home. Then the virus is gone and we can go out again and we can continue with our plans as before, because we had everything lined up for our contract work business. Because before what we had to do, we had, it was always selling our time, basically. So we said to the client, okay, you need us for 5 days, you pay us for 5 days, it's good. The problem is this is not very scalable, because if you sell 5 days, I can see how many people I have, how many days we have per month, and this is how much money we can make. It's very hard to then use this money to make games. So we were like trying to move more into an area where we can sell stuff like white label solutions, do it once for clients, then sell it again as a product. So everything was lined up, and then the pandemic hit, and everything didn't happen for us. So if I would have known back then that this Corona thingy is here for like 3+ years, I would have gone crazy, I guess, and have been so afraid. So because back then we always tried to have like at least the next 3 to 4 months of salary and expenses in on our bank account, so we had some buffer. But if I know what would happen, I would have freaked out probably. So, but because of our thinking went from half a year basically down to like, okay, let's survive the next 4 weeks. It was fine, and we got through this. In the end, porting games on the platforms turned out much more fun and interesting than making stuff for clients, because it translates much better to help us in our own games. Before it was like using our knowledge from games to help clients. Now it's more like, okay, we help clients, but we also help our future us by making games to more platforms. So it was kind of nice. So we did some stuff for, all the consoles. We ported some stuff to Stadia, to mobile. Every platform which was available at the time, we did some stuff, and it was kind of nice.
So what was when the pandemic hit? So your team basically worked remotely, or that's how it was before?
No, we worked here on site, and we just in February basically we moved into a new office. So we just said, okay, we're gonna move now in a bigger office because we need some space. We want to grow the company. We want to be ready to. We already prepared some rooms like for the event business. So we had like, okay, we can do more like the client stuff here. We can have meeting rooms here. We can greet clients here. So we moved in a much bigger space in February. Also much more expensive space. Not just bigger, also more expensive. And then like 1 month later, we weren't even done with getting everything in here. It was like, yeah, now go out. And then I was sitting at home like for the next, I don't know, 1-2 years. And was like, okay, but we still pay now this, I don't know, 50K per year for this empty office where no one is. It was like, yeah, cool. This sounds like a very great investment. So the timing for the office was kind of bad. But I mean, it worked out. But this is what I mean. It's a lot of problems came with this.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, you're churning out products while remotely working, and I just can't wrap my mind around how, you know, the pipeline. I understand that you guys are German, so it has to be immaculate, especially on the documentation. But I mean, programming, remote work, that stuff is, I mean, I just can't wrap my mind around that. Well, you're able to churn out, like, how does even the pipeline work and documentation and all the programming stuff? You managed to make that.
It's very, very hard to say. It's summer, so we had like, Jira or Trello for project management, of course, stuff like this to keep track of the task. Then we have like, we used in the first like Google Docs or the Microsoft stuff from them. Then we switch over to Notion at some point to have like our own online library of knowledge in there and just put everything there. We tried to over communicate, but it was hard. I mean, I cannot say we solved it and it was fine. It was a great time. During the pandemic, we started a new game project, which is an IO smarter than a fifth grader. It's a game for an American TV show. And because it's a TV show, so you roughly know what the project is about. So you know, like, okay, it's a quiz show where grown-ups compete against children. So you roughly have an idea what the game is and how it could be. So the scope was kind of limited from the get-go. So this helped quite a lot in figuring out what we do and how we do it, because you didn't have to go into a big prototyping phase where you say, like, hey, we can do everything, because you couldn't. And this was, the game was basically like work for THQ Nordic and Handy Games. They asked us to make the game, and this fitted in quite nice because we could finally start growing the team. So when we went into the pandemic, we were 7 people, and when we got asked like, "Hey, do you want to make this game?" and it has a kind of high budget, at least for our budgets we had before, we could now finally go like, okay, we can hire people for 3D, we can hire people for QA, we can hire people for audio, we can build a proper team and everything, and this blended in quite nicely with the situation because the game was not that challenging, complicated, and it was an okay challenge to manage for people who have not much experience, because also like the founders team and now the leadership team, almost everyone of us is quite new in this position, so. It's not just, I mean, we have a lot of stuff like, yeah, you have now a junior programmer and senior programmer, whatever, but the same for leadership. So we had to learn a lot of stuff, and the pandemic just made everything a bit harder and more complicated. Also, there were a lot of stuff where people were just, like some people, it was fine for them staying at home all the time. Some people were just suffering. So it was also hard to manage those people and just to go on a human level and just try to support people as best as possible. So it was a complete challenge. So documentation and other stuff helps a bit, but it was challenging and very hard and not very easy. I don't want to go through this again. So please, no, not another pandemic.
No more.
No, no pandemics, hopefully. Please. One was hopefully enough for now.
But yeah. By the way, I also interested to know about, you mentioned before that multi-platform always in your DNA, and like judging for your games like the Spitlings and then Are You Smarter Than the Fifth Graders, all of them is online, or like not online, maybe multiplayer games. Is that also in your DNA? I mean, like, what is the DNA of like the vision of Massive Mini?
Yeah, so the it's not, so it's somehow in our DNA, but not really by choice. I'm just thinking how I'm phrasing this. So when we made Spitlings, I also don't know how much I can talk about it, but it should be fine because now, because what's about Stadia, and Stadia doesn't exist anymore like it existed before. So we made Spitlings. At some point, Google approached us and asked like, hey, do you want to have this as a launch title or launch window title for Stadia? And we said, oh yeah, sure. But they said, you have to have online multiplayer because we really like the game, but playing like, because it was a couch co-op game or couch multiplayer game, which is really not happening during a pandemic, so it made sense for them to ask to make it online. We said, yeah, of course, we can make it online. So we figured out how to make it online very late in development, which wasn't a very fun task to do because the game was, a lot of systems weren't ready for this stuff, so we had to basically rebuild the entire foundation of the game to make it happen for online, and this also stopped our designers from designing new features because all programmers were working on making it ready for multiplayer, so it was okay, but it was a challenge. So then we had like the knowledge on how to make multiplayer games on all the platforms, so we could make multiplayer on other consoles, on PC, on the Stadia. We also had like a mobile version running at some point for this stuff, so then we had this knowledge. And then I was one of the Fifth Grader is local couch multiplayer, which is like, they didn't ask for online, but we still have the tech basically. And for our current project, it's again online multiplayer, because we thought like, we have the knowledge, we have the experience, we can use it, even if it is a lot of pain sometimes to do this, because it's not that easy. Even now, like, because we still look, when we do some online stuff, we still look at papers, HGC talks or whatever from like the 90s. Because turns out not everything has changed since then, so internet connections are still unreliable or slow sometimes, so you still have to think like of having like this very old connections. So this knowledge is quite useful what we have, and we now try to implement it. Not sure if it's now part of our DNA, but I would say maybe. So what we don't want to do, what we did for Spitlings, was like we mixed online multiplayer with local multiplayer. This is a pain. Because you have so many guidelines for submissions which you have to follow through. So we had like our QA sort of like, yeah, we have for this platform over 1,000 test cases just for user stuff. And was like, yeah, okay, enjoy then. So we're not going to do this again. So online multiplayer is fine. It's a challenge. Our programmers kind of like it because they like to be challenged. But yeah, I'm not sure if every project will have this in the future. Maybe just to test it out, we want to have like just a single player experience at some point and see how this turns out. Who knows?
Who knows?
Can we get a timeline for Oddspikes?
Yeah. So, I mean, early access release should be early next year somehow. So yeah, we started the game 1.5 years ago, had a prototype before, and now like in, what is, half a year, a bit more, we expect to hit early access on PC. And then let's see how long early access goes. It's more about...
I was hoping that you'll show some or gameplay for Aspasia in Gamescom.
No, not really. We thought first if we're gonna do it, but we want to figure out a different way because before we had Spitlinks, so we, this is like, Spitlinks has like one stick and two buttons. That's it, that's other controls. So we could just print it on the booth and just say, hey, press these two buttons and do this to play. And it was just drop in, drop out multiplayer. So it was a very funny game to show on Gamescom and other events because people just could play it easily. For Oddsmarks, it's an automation game, which I don't know how long it takes you to understand the game, but I guess like 40, 45 minutes you need to see something of the game. And this is very hard doing it on Gamescom, for example. A few years ago, I went to Gamescom and played Civilization 6 when it was not out at the time. Yeah. And I went to this room and played for, and even though the Civilization 5 and 4 and the other games, but it was still hard to understand, and I had like I guess half an hour and I didn't understand much. So I was like, okay, Oddsmarks is not the best game to show on events like this. Maybe it's more like a game where you can put out a demo for a limited amount of time during some event and put it out and let people play it home in their own pace. Maybe you're gonna do this. We just have to find the right event and not just shadow drop a demo out there. So we're looking if we can do this at some time before release to give people more time to play and understand the game because it's not that complicated. But automation games are it's more like an entry level game to the automation genre. It tries to open the genre a bit for more people, but still it's a bit more complicated for people who have never played this. For people who played Factorio or Satisfactory, for example, it's very easy. But for people who played other games before, they might need a bit more time. So hopefully we have an event at some point where we can just put a demo out public and people can play it.
I see. I mean, like, what the reason behind choosing this genre? I mean, is the ideas come from, like, the idea first we want to do this and finding the market, or, like, you look into the trend and I think this genre going to fit in the future?
Yeah, basically kind of like this. So our publisher Handy Games approached us like, hey, we see a market here for these type of games. They wanted to have a little bit different type of game from us, and then we started prototyping and we had like, I don't know, 6 or 7 prototypes in like 4 months or something. Every prototype moved a bit more and more to automation because this is somehow, because we had 2 people on this, two co-founders worked on this, and this automation genre was something they wanted to do. And I don't know if this was planned like this from them, but prototype by prototype, they moved one step closer to an automation genre. In the end, we ended up in an automation game. And then we looked at the market, looked what other games, how many units they are selling, what games are coming out, and all the stuff. And then was like, yeah, we could do something like this because we have the team. Also, our team was interested in doing this stuff. And then we had like the team was excited, the publisher was excited. There was a market position for the game, so it just then got green lighted, and then we started doing it.
Do you have any like framework to test a prototype, whether this is a go or no go, or like what's the KPI for you to do like a green light? Like, okay, we're gonna do this project.
Not really. It's something we have to get better at prototyping, because for now it was just like, do we like it, and does the team like it, does the publisher like it? It was just playing the game and showing to people and getting like feedback on it, and also getting feedback on the business case, because we were always looking, when we made games, we were always not trying to make a good game, we were always looking at, okay, we also have a good business case, so we can sell this thing, and it kind of worked out. So we don't have a good framework for doing this. We want to get better at it with our next project and just have like spend more time in finding out how we want to do prototyping in the future, because also right now we have a bigger team, and we have now 28 people, and we have to get a good process running, how we do prototypes and how other people can maybe submit some ideas. So we have an internal game jam roughly once per year, sometimes every second year, depends a little bit on our schedule. This is one way which we're trying out to get more ideas from the team. But so far, we are just looking what other companies are doing and try to learn from them how we can improve prototyping and also pre-production. Because also pre-production was kind of hard for us on this game, because just out of scheduling reasons from the game before, which was I guess Smarter Than a Fifth Grader, like the entire team was ready for pre-production at the same time, and then just having a rough prototype and then telling like, hey, here, by the way, here, you did your prototype, you too, cool, here are 15 people, enjoy getting enough tasks for them and getting them aligned with the vision, bye. This was maybe not the best part, but we couldn't do it differently because the people were there, they needed to work some stuff, but then just trying to find work for 15 people when the vision is not quite clear, and then trying to align people on a vision which is not clear for you, it was very hard. So we have to get better at figuring out when do we move people over to which project phase and how can we prepare a project for the team to join. It was a bit rough this time.
Do you have 28 crew right now on the team?
Yep.
And I also read on your website that one of the value that you believe in your team is like diversity, creative, passionate. And the first sentences on the website is like you have like 10 different countries working on the Massive Mini. Is that something that you believe will bring value added into your team, having more diversity, or like there's a I don't know, maybe culture clash happening when you're running the company? What happened?
Yeah, it's very important for us. So we started the company and we basically hired the people we know, and so we quickly started with like being 5 white dudes, and then going from there, getting more diverse was quite hard. Finding someone who wants to join like this. It wasn't a bro culture, but it can look like it, right? If you have a company or team out of 5 or 6 dudes, can look a bit weird for people to join. So it was a bit hard to start finding the first women's, and then it was we wanted to have like at least for genders a 50-50 split. So then we started to look out more for this and hiring more people. So. This worked out quite well. And during the pandemic, I have to think how it happened. But we started getting the first people from outside of Europe. So inside Europe, some people moved from Spain or Italy or France to Germany. Inside Europe, it's quite easy to move because you can just move. So as a European, you can just move around. EU, you don't need to fill any papers. For example, I could now decide to move tomorrow to, I don't know, Portugal, and I can work from there. It's fine. So this wasn't a big issue. It was, of course, some stuff about helping people to start a life in Germany and help them. Hey, this is the paperwork you have to do. You have to go here first and here and then this. And this is how taxes works. This is how this stuff works. So this was, we had to learn this stuff, but this was, because the people had not many problems to move here, was quite easy to do. I guess it was just like explain everything and document it and give it as a handout also, like people can also look it up. But then at some point we started getting people from outside of Europe, like Russia and Iran and Lebanon. And this was a bit more complicated then because they were, it's their home country, and then we had to get like a work permit for them here. And at the time when we did the first time, we didn't know what we're getting into it and how long it takes. So I guess being naive and a bit stupid helped, because we learned the process from the get-go then. It's not that hard, to be honest. It's just a lot of waiting. And because you have to fill out a form, wait 2 weeks for it, then do it again. Then you have to get like everything translated into German. Then they have to check up, how is your university degree? What is it in Germany compared to? Is it enough to move over here and all the stuff? And in general, the answer is always yes, but it just takes like half a year to get the stuff signed on. So if you want to have someone like, hey, I want to start have this person here next month or in like 6 weeks or whatever, that's not happening. So you have to have like a timeline where you think like, okay, I need a person in half a year. And this is quite hard. for us back then, it worked out because we had like a team which could have, which was staffed over time, so we could wait for a few months. It was fine. Also, sometimes people started working as a freelancer in the time before working for us from their home country, and during the pandemic it was fine because the time zones were quite close to ours. So if the person is like plus 1 or plus 2 hours, it's fine. It worked out. So yeah, that's how we moved the people over here. And now we have like a big diverse team. Also having, we are based in Cologne. We have the Cologne Game Lab. It's University for Games, basically next to us, but in the city. And since you don't have to pay for university in Germany, they basically can say, hey, we can get students from all over the world. And this is also what they try. So their mission is to just get a very diverse very diverse students in. And this helps us because the people who are coming out there, like we have some person from Bangladesh, from the Philippines, who are coming from the Cologne Game Lab. And this also helps us. So some people are coming from Europe, some people are coming from the Cologne Game Lab, which have then a student work permit thingy, and then it gets transferred to a normal work permit, and some people relocate. So we right now have a lot of knowledge how to do all the stuff. We have like 2 persons who take care of this, and we also have a lot of stuff of knowledge and experience with getting people onboarded, explaining to them. We have like, for example, one insurance guy who comes in once per year, and he can talk English, and he just explains how everything works here for insurance in Germany. And we try to just offer this for people to help them getting onboard on this stuff. And in return, we have a very diverse team out of many, many countries right now, which is quite nice. We didn't have any culture clashes so far. I mean, we have 1 person from Ukraine, 1 person from Russia, but this doesn't affect them. What is right now happening on a geopolitical scale? But of course, when there are sometimes some stuff about how to give feedback, how feedback is received, which you then have to understand. Of course, there was different smaller things, but nothing which you'll just learn it while it's happening, and that this can happen. It's fine. So no big problems, but in return we have a very diverse team. We have many different opinions. It says quite a lot. Because I come from a very, very small village where everyone knows each other, like, I don't know, 100 people in the small village. So it's a completely different coming up from there, going to a big city, then working with all the people from around the world. You learn so much stuff, just how mundane things are happening in their countries and everything. So it's quite nice to have this. We also have like this stuff where people cook some stuff from which they eat in their country. Sometimes you have sessions where they can just share what is happening in the country right now when there's some stuff is going on, like when in Iran everything happened in the last couple of months. It was highlighted from some people here, like, okay, this is happening, it's happening because of this, and this is a problem here, and this is how my life was there. You learn a lot of stuff about different cultures and how it is in other countries, which is quite nice. And I guess also it helps our games to have like a bigger, more cultures contributing to this product we are making.
Yeah, it sounds amazing to work there.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, you managed to do that for like 28 people. That's amazing. I thought Germany was famous for its bureaucracy. So, I mean, for you to manage to have like that many people from all over the world is crazy.
Yeah, there's right now. So as many countries, the citizens of Germany getting older and not many young people coming after them. So it's a bit, you can see that in the next, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years, we have a problem here. So because we don't have enough young people to support the old people, and pension and all the stuff is just a problem. So they are trying to make it easier for companies to get people from other countries into Germany. But right now, this is just talking from politicians. There's no actions happening, so it's still the same painful long process for us. But what we do is like we go on every level, like talking to the city, talking to the state, talking to the government, and just sharing our experiences and say like, okay, is this the process you intended to have for us? Is this what you think is right? And they said no, we try to change it. Yeah, a lot of stuff should happen in the next few years. Right now, yes, it's a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of filling out forms and putting in redundant informations all the time. It's quite annoying. We try to take care of it as much as possible. It's getting better, but very slowly. But I hope if we, talk in 3, 4, 5 years, we can say, yeah, now it's much improved. So I'm a little bit optimistic about this, that it gets easier. Right now, it's not very hard. It's just this process is so long and you can't plan with it. So I know telling someone, yeah, you want to have this person, maybe wait half a year, maybe 1 year, who knows? It's very, it's very hard to plan.
It could take a year.
Was half a year, but I also heard about companies who waited 1.5 years for some other stuff because they had some redo some stuff and everything. It's just annoying. For us, it was like 5 to 6 months in all cases. Still a long time. But I heard from much longer times other companies. And I can understand when people ask, like, hey, I have someone I need next month. Yeah, this is not possible doing it like this, hiring people from other countries. It would work if you have, like, people from university, but then you have to have the luck to have the right university in your city, in your country, whatever. We are lucky with the Cologne Game Lab, but not every company is, so it's a bit hard to do this.
Doing all of the hassle, like, you're looking, for example, you're looking for like a programmer. You can just hire easily from Germany, but you chose to open into like more country to join your company with all of the hassle. Is it also a reflect or like benefit to your game or like your process in the creative of development too, having diverse team?
Yeah. I just have to think why we did it in the first place. I guess we had the time. We knew we need someone in some months. So we were like, okay, we can look for more people. And also we wanted to have like some different experiences or experience at all. And then the first person from we hired was like the sister of someone who's already here, which came over a student visa. I was like, hey, my sister is a programmer and she could join, but she's sitting still in Iran. So we moved her over. So it started like this. Yeah, it helps us quite a lot to get us, because games are made all over the world and sometimes different games, but you have people with experiences in other countries. Not everyone who's making games sits in Europe or United States or whatever. So it's quite nice to get these people here. We had the time to get these people with the experiences they had. It was so far very beneficial for us. And I guess worth the time, but it's not possible for every position because sometimes you need a person much sooner than later. So we have some of our 3D artists came from Russia. She's very talented. It's very hard to find someone here, for example. So just having this much talent coming over was worth the wait.
I see. Other than the timeline issue, when you try to hire people from around the world, from your observation, reviewing maybe like a resume portfolio from all over the world, do you see any like gap in terms of like the skill and experience from developers in Germany with other country?
Not really, no. I guess there's a lot of good universities all over the globe. So I saw good applications from other countries, bad applications, but the same is for Germany. So I cannot say that applications from this country are like this. For us, they are comparable in general. And it's more like the environment where you make games is also kind of interesting because we have some person from Lebanon, and when we had the calls, the interviews with her, she told us, yeah, I have only power for 3 hours per day. So we have to find time for the interview in these 3 hours, because in the other hours they don't have energy at home right now because of a shutdown in the city and whatever. So and if you think like, okay, if this person can make games in this environment, how much can she do when she's here? If you have like a proper environment which supports people, was like, okay, if you can survive there, it gets a bit easier for you here then. This was one of the reasons why we got these people. So they have sometimes a different experience, just life experience, than we have here, which is good to have also.
That is nice. And you also have a doc in your team.
Yeah, we have multiple docs. So from the get-go, we decided to allow docs here in the office. So our office has very, very high ceilings. So even if you have allergies, it shouldn't be a big problem. But of course, if people have allergies, we ask them if it's fine. If it's, we have one person and he says, yeah, it's okay. So we have the docs here. They are good for motivation. Not
moral officer.
Yeah, and not always good for productivity, let's say like this. But also, at least when the doc has to go out 2 or 3 times per day, so you get people off the desk sometimes and get them moving, get them out to fresh air. It's also kind of helpful, I guess, in general to have them around. It's sometimes a bit chaos, depending on because you have like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 docs sometimes. It's not, they're not here all the time at the same time, but sometimes you have multiple docs here. And depending on which docs are here, it's sometimes more, sometimes less loud and stressful. It's quite interesting. And also our community manager, she is quite happy to have like docs because she can just exploit them for content and get easy liked.
And you know what's cute? They're on your website too, on the list of your team. Yeah. Like moral officer. Wait,
really?
Yes.
You have the docs and the team list?
Yes.
Yeah. And also in the credits of the games. Not just on the website, we also put them in credits because they kind of work here. They don't get paid by money, they get paid by snacks and treats and whatever.
I think that's nice to replicate.
Yeah,
all right.
We should.
Oh, go ahead, Sonny.
No, I mean, I think a lot of studios should do that. I mean, it's good for stress too. I mean, dogs.
Yeah, I understand if you have like maybe smaller offices and then people's allergies can be a problem, but for us it wasn't so far. We don't want to make it stressful for people or people are afraid of dogs, but so far we managed quite good. So it's worked out.
Are the dogs also from around the world? They first.
I don't know, the bureaucracy would be too bad for dogs.
We have where the dogs from? Mostly Europe, different countries in Europe, like Italy. I have one dog, it's a foster dog, which I bring to the office. She's coming from Romania, so it's more like more European dogs, less around the world. So, but yeah, also our dogs are a bit diverse.
Yeah, man, it's great to hear Massive and what you guys are doing there. It seems like a dream place to work.
Yeah, that was the idea, basically, to build a place where we as founders team wanted to work but couldn't find in our area to make this happen. It took us some time to do this, starting with the contract work stuff talked about at the beginning of the podcast. But now I guess we find in a position where we can make our own game with a big, nice team. It's a lot of fun. A lot of stress, but also a lot of fun. So we are quite happy right now.
What is your dream goal for you? What kind of game that you want to achieve, or like the your dream game that you want to make?
We never had like a dream game. We never started the company like, okay, I want to make like the World of Warcraft killer or the GTA killer. We never did this. So we always wanted to. Our goal was like, we would like to make games in our 50s. So I'm now turned 32 this year. So if I can do this in 20-25 years, would be nice. And if I'm not being forced into working for an insurance company to make a living, would be kind of nice to just be able to make games even in like 25 years. Would be great. So this was our goal, just to get old in the industry. This would be nice. This is what we're trying.
That is very, very nice goal. Simple, nice, and very, very interesting. Keep making games until 50s.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a different set of experience you then have, right? So I played the Monkey Island game, the latest one, and it's also, they have a letter in the end where they just explain, hey, now we like 30 years older than we made the first game, and we have a lot of life experience. It was kind of nice to just see, okay, how might a game change, which you made like in your 20s compared to your 50s, for example, and I would like to see us doing this. So just see, okay, how can we use our experience maybe in 25 years for making games? How would our games then look like?
Nice.
Yeah, I hope I can play your games in the near future.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
All right. Tim, I know it was a very nice discussion that we have, and really, really a lot of things that we want to deep dive more from you, but I think we almost run up the time. So we're going to use the last question to for you to give maybe some kind of like, I don't know, tips or like best practice or like the I don't know, maybe like your, from your experience, if you can start it all over again from the beginning, what's your message or like tips for the new developers who wants to start to jump into the industry?
Yeah, basically just make stuff. I mean, it doesn't have to be, if I look at my history, it doesn't have to be in university, just grabbing, I don't know, Unity, Unreal, Godot, or other stuff. Just make games or just make art, whatever. Just start doing some stuff, talk to people, show to people, get feedback on it, and just start doing it. It doesn't have to wait for like a perfect opportunity to make games, because this will not arrive. You just have to force your luck sometimes a bit and just start doing stuff, and things will happen, I guess. Like, I don't know, if you just have to, yeah, force your luck somehow and try to find other opportunities. They don't come if you don't do anything. So yeah, doing stuff, be visible. I guess this would be, if I would have to talk to myself like 15 years ago, I guess I would tell myself something like this.
I see. Yeah, I think that's really, really accurate, because a lot of developers is quite, I don't know, maybe shy or like hesitant to show their works, like, so they keep making but they don't show it to other people and getting feedback, so it's going nowhere. Thank you so much, Tim, for your time. Very happy
to have you.
Yes, and I think that's it for today, yeah, Sony. I hope today's session can give all of you who's listening to and watching this podcast courage to press start your journey into the game industry. That's it for today's episode, and special because from today's, usually we have our tagline is keep playing games and start making games, but because of you, we're going to change it to keep playing games, start making games, and keep making games until we are in our 50s. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you so much.
Hey, don't forget to wishlist. Don't forget to wishlist.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Wishlist the game. That is correct.
Yeah, that would be very nice. Yeah, yeah, very appreciated. Yeah.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.